Welcome to a new episode of PMCA Research Chat. I'm your host and PMCA Research Chair, Eric Schmoyer, from Barrichello. Our objective is to form and educate our listeners on current and previous research committee-funded topics and personalities. Please subscribe and like us on your podcast service. Check us out at PMCA.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. In our first series of podcasts, we're focusing on some of our academic advisors. Joining me today is Dr. Richard Hartel, one of PMCA's most steadfast supporters and partners. Dr. Hartel is professor of food engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He earned his BA in physics from the State University College of New York at Potsdam and went on to earn both his MS and subsequent PhD in agricultural engineering from Colorado State University. Rich has been a veritable font of knowledge with regard to fat and sugar crystallization, presenting his learnings at confectionery industry events too numerous to count, as well as being an accomplished author, most recently publishing Confectionery Science and Technology in 2017. He is a professor of food science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Please join me in welcoming Rich Hartel to Research Chat. Dr. Hartel, did I miss anything?
Oh, that's probably enough.
So tell us a little about yourself.
Well, how much time you got, right? No, very briefly. So I grew up on Long Island, just in a working class neighborhood just outside of New York City. Got out of there as quickly as I could, went to a small school in upstate New York. I like to joke that I had to stay in state, but I wanted to stay as far away from home as possible, and that's why I chose Potsdam. After that, I went off to grad school and got a degree in engineering. Went to work at Eastman Kodak for a while as a research chemical engineer. Realized that industry was not my forte, that I liked to be my own boss, and decided that I was going to pursue an academic career. And eventually, after a little bit of zigzagging, ended up here at the University of Wisconsin.
So when did you decide to pursue a career in food science?
Well, to be honest, I didn't even know food science existed until I was in grad school. I was in grad school as an engineer, and for whatever reason, my office mate was the son of the food science department head. And so I said, oh, there's a food science program. Now, in ag engineering, one of the emphases is foods, and I was in that particular emphasis. So it just seemed like a natural fit. However, like I said, once I graduated, I then went to Eastman Kodak and kind of let the food side go aside. But then when I was looking for academic positions, then I decided that food was probably where I was most trained and would most likely find a position. And fortunately, was able to land here at the University of Wisconsin.
And has your experience lined up with your expectations?
Well, coming in with few expectations, I'd say it's exceeded that by a large amount. So what the department has here, what the university has here, is exceptional, and it's been great for me to land here.
How did you find yourself involved with the student advisor end of things? I mean, I've known you since I took the resident course 25 years ago.
Yep. Well, it's hard to say when it started, although I've always had an inclination towards students and learning, but I spent the first 6 years of my career here getting tenure, which is basically doing research and teaching whatever I needed to. So it was only after I got tenure that I decided that the student side of things interested me just as much. And so, I mean, there was a key point in my career where I was teaching a class and I was really bored teaching it, and I looked around and said, well, these guys must be really bored while I'm standing here being bored. And I decided that I could do one of two things. I could just teach as needed to get by, or I could take it seriously and try and do a good job. And of course, that's what I did. So once I started talking and thinking through student learning, then it was a quick step to being an academic advisor. I've been the advisor of the Food Science Club almost since I've been here. So 1980, 87 or 88 or something like that. So been an advisor for a long time, and it's probably one of the most enjoyable things that I find about my job is working with a new crop of students every year.
Is there any piece of your research that's given you the most personal satisfaction?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I honestly, I have a hard time picking any single one. And I think probably that's because the feeling of enjoyment, reward that comes from, you know, almost any development of new knowledge. So anytime a student comes up with, the next new thing. So for example, one of my students last year kind of correlated rheology of chocolate with interfacial tension between fat and the sugar phase. And to see that connection just kind of went bing in my head. And so I wouldn't say that was necessarily, you know, the main one, but it's that kind of thing that I enjoy about what I do.
Has any piece of research taken you off in a completely different direction than your initial, than its initial goal?
Yeah, so my initial goal was I studied crystallization in grad school, and that was what I did at Eastman Kodak as well. So that's sort of always been the focus of what I do is phase transitions. However, one year, a clinical doctor in medical school approached me and asked if she could borrow a rheometer because she wanted to measure the rheological properties of thickened fluids for people that had swallowing problems. And that kind of led into kind of a huge thing for a while where we were focused on thickened fluids and studying how people swallow and how the rheological properties of thick fluids influence the success of swallowing. So that's probably the main thing that's kind of been a branch offshoot of what I normally do.
That's really interesting because I got a personal connection. My wife's a speech pathologist, and for some time she was doing dysphagia videos, swallowing with stroke patients, which that kind of piqued my curiosity when I read that on your bio.
Yeah, it's an interesting area, and we're still working on it, although the person that first approached me has now retired, but her replacement is interested in saliva and how saliva influences swallowing properties. So we're still talking about, you know, what's our next project going to be. So it's not ending. We've sort of been in a hiatus for a while. But yeah, some of those videos of the X-ray fluoroscopy, watching a bolus of fluid go down the throat or not go down the throat successfully is pretty interesting. I've actually brought that into one of my classes, so a food functionality class. We talk about hydrocolloids and what effect that has, particularly on thickened fluids and dysphagia.
I remember my wife talking about using a thickening agent in the fluid they were doing the testing with, but she had no idea what she was dealing with other than just mixing this stuff and making it thicker.
Yeah, and combining the rheology stuff that we do with, you know, they measure pressure differences as people swallow. And then again, they have ways of measuring mouth coating. They have ways of measuring success of a swallow using these barium laced fluids. And it's pretty interesting.
Yep. Yes, it is. So is there a research subject you would love to investigate, but haven't had the opportunity?
Yeah, so one of the advantages of what I do and how I've managed to do things is that I have a lot of freedom to do what I want. I mean, most of my work gets funded, and so it's a specific topic, although I get to choose that topic. But I also have the ability I have grad students that have really open-ended projects. So, you know, it's really a matter of what I want to do and what they want to do. However, I think there's a couple areas that I thought would be, really interesting for me as sort of a second field. Maybe even for a while, I was thinking of a second PhD in something like educational psychology. So, you know, I take teaching pretty seriously and thought that, you know, maybe if I learned more about educational psychology, I'd be better at it. My joke is that I read a book, figured I knew enough, and moved on to something else. But Lately, my direction has been more towards material science, which kind of makes sense given I have a background in physics and engineering. So I have a current USDA project in on collapse of foam type materials with a guy in material science, and we're hoping it gets funded and can really start building that collaboration.
I'm going to use that as a segue into my next question, which was, can you describe how the funding works from your perspective? I mean, how do you get money? How is it distributed? What is enough?
There's never enough.
I knew it. The minute it came out, I thought
that's how academics think is there's never enough. And so the bottom line is you write proposal after proposal after proposal, and then you hope that you hit. And generally, I mean, you know, a USDA grant, you get something like 10%, although my success rate's been much, much higher than that. So I kind of think that, you know, for every proposal I write, I hope that I get half of them funded, so 50% success.
Wow.
But, you know, and that includes the USDA grants, but it includes a lot of smaller ones too, like a PMCA grant, for example. And I write grants to the National Dairy Council as well. And again, usually those are pretty successful, so they help my success rate. But like I said, I've also been pretty successful with USDA grants. So once you have an idea, like this idea that that we're working on now is collapse of foam type structures, and I'm thinking specifically of melting ice cream and whipped cream and how they collapse as a function of time, as a function of the material structure. So we have put together this proposal that incorporates both the experimental side of measuring the collapse, actually quantifying data, and then the material science guy is actually going to help model based on the physical principles. So again, it's kind of a, you know, an interesting collaboration. Again, much of my recent work has been done in interdisciplinary, which I think is what everybody wants to hear, that that you're working with people that bring in some kind of outside stuff. So assuming a project gets funded, then the money comes to the university. The university takes their share, and then I'm free to spend the rest. And I usually have designed the proposal so it funds a grad student or a postdoc or both, or something like that. And then I look for an appropriate student that's going to fit the project, that brings the right skills and things like that, and then help the student work their way through the project until ultimately we can write a final report, we have to write a final report, but often it leads to, well, what's the next idea that's going to come out of this? And it's the same way with the dysphagia stuff, that, you know, we had a project, we've done some work, we've kind of taken a hiatus, although we have some ideas about what might be the next area. And so we're working on thinking through how we would build a proposal, where we would get funding for it, and things like that. So it's a, you know, it's a long process, but, and it's difficult. You know, I've been saying for a long time now that I'd hate to be an assistant professor because the funding is pretty limited these days. And then there's people like me that feel like I should get every grant. But I think there's, you know, there's still a lot of opportunity for a new faculty member to find a niche and build a, you know, build a research program.
You mentioned crossover, multidisciplinary type things. How would that affect the sensitivity of IPs if you've got different disciplines and different grant providers crossing similar territory?
Well, typically, so University of Wisconsin is a little bit unique, I think, because, you know, we have a patent arm who brings in millions of dollars a year based on patent royalties. Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, or WARF, and there's a rule that if you have federal money in your lab, that you have to go through WARF with any IP. And so, you know, because I have a lot of USDA grants, everything, if I want to think about IP, It goes through WARF, and it's the same whether it's in the medical school, whether it's in material science. So all of us, if they have a USDA grant or federal money, which they would if they work with me, have to go through WARF. And WARF has first rights of refusal. But the great thing is that they take care of everything. So they'll write up everything. All you have to do is submit an invention disclosure, and basically they take it from there, you know, including doing the background work, including writing up the patent, the patent detail itself, and filing it and working through all the, you know, the BS that comes with filing a patent. And so in many respects, that's a pretty convenient thing for me. There's some faculty who's seems like their focus is patents. So I know a faculty member who, when he goes to talk to an industry member, he brings his own lawyer to make sure he doesn't say anything to the company that breaks his IP. But I'm not like that. You know, my attitude is primarily to develop new knowledge and put it out there so people can use it. Not that I want to, I make zero money on patent royalties. And most of the patents that I have are simply because somebody else wanted to do it. And what am I going to say? No. So I go along with it. But none of it's made any money. Now, on the other side of that, and maybe what's more interesting to your research members is industry funding. And I do a fair amount of industry research, and have over the years. And that's always a challenge. So IP is generally one of the two snagging points when it comes to writing, to agreeing on a contract between the university and the company. So of course, the company thinks that if we put the money in, then we get the IP. University says, no, that's not the way it works. You put the money in, but we get the IP, and we'll give you some concessions for that. And I've seen projects, you know, blow up simply because of that. So IP can be a pretty interesting roadblock to industry research. But nevertheless, you know, I've still managed to do a fair amount of industry work where it's been basic enough that there's no real perspective of IP, and so the companies are willing to sign it.
Do you find that your situation is kind of anomalous, or do all academic institutions have that that patent writing or protection division?
And only having worked at UW-Madison during my career, I don't really know. My understanding is that, you know, universities take a clear interest in what people do completely. In fact, in some place, so the if I did not have USDA funding, then the policy here is that the IP is mine. And I've known faculty members here that have refused federal funding simply because they found patenting more lucrative to fund their research. And I think that's unique. And it's only because I have federal funding that I'm kind of beholden to WARF. But I think most universities say we own the information, not the faculty member.
Right.
Whether everybody has the same, I mean, I don't think every school has the same level of focus that Wisconsin does, you know, based on WARF bringing in millions of dollars in royalties every year. It's a huge function that promotes research, teaching, graduate education, all that kind of stuff. And of course they protect it pretty carefully. So I don't really have a good perspective of what others go through. I don't think it's quite as stringent as what we have here.
It's interesting because, and this is probably a little off topic, but when you consider the educational experience crossing over into marketing, sales, and everything else going through that particular department, the experience you could glean from that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have that business perspective, you know, even though I work a lot with companies and, you know, and have a sense of what corporate interests are. Again, my interest is just doing good science and publishing those results so that they benefit everybody.
Sticking to that thread, since you brought up lucrative and making money, let's talk about your book. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
So You know, my mentor, Joe Von Elp, he was department head here for many years, but he was on the committee that hired me as a faculty member. I still don't know why they did it, but they did it. And when I got here, Joe said, you know, your first task is to sit through the 3-week candy course. You know, what the course back then was 3 weeks. I don't know if it was 3 weeks when you took it, Eric.
Two,
yeah. So that was after 92 when we switched. And so I sat through the three-week candy course. You know, back then it was sponsored by NCA. And it was kind of eye-opening experience. And over the years, Joe and I kept talking about, well, you know, what's the next thing? And, you know, the big candy book was the Menifee book. And it was actually, I think, Joe's idea to say, well, let's revise the Menifee book. And so I think the earliest contract we had with the publisher was, the next edition of the Menifee book. And then over the years, that kind of faded away. The energy barrier to get over to actually write anything was just too big. And ultimately, at some point, I decided that, well, I'm just going to write my own book. But then there's still a huge energy barrier. Joe helped a little bit, but, you know, he was kind of retiring and phasing out of work. And this was probably, Joe retired in 98, so I'm sure we were talking about the book in 95. And it wasn't until somewhere around 2015 that I decided that I was never going to get that book done by myself. And Joe had basically retired out of it. And that's when I called in Randy and said, you know, can you help me get over this hump? And that's, you know, he's really the impetus that got it to where it isn't being published. But, you know, it's kind of a compilation of the candy course. Basically, everything that's in that book comes from the candy course, as well as the research that I've done and kind of combining those together. So I do see that as one of my major achievements in the field, is getting all of that compiled in one place. And as I noted, there's plenty of flaws in it, but that's what a second edition is for, to try and correct some of those mistakes and build on what we got. But I think as a first edition, it's actually quite an achievement.
Can you talk about the candy course, how it's transitioned from the NCA sponsored to where you are today?
Sure. So again, Joe started that course in 1963, or I should say NCA approached University of Wisconsin-Madison. And they were in Chicago at the time, and UW-Madison was one of the three close universities. And they chose to come up and look at Madison. And Joe was one of the faculty members that was involved with it. In fact, I have a picture of the 1963 class, and there's Joe and Owen Fenema, you know, the guy that wrote the food chemistry book. And they're both kind of the initial starters of the candy course. And so it's been going since 1963. We've taught it every summer up till this year. So this year, you know, because of where we're at, we have not offered an in-person course. We have a virtual course that's going on now. And it's an interesting compilation of lectures that we actually recorded back in 2018, and a whole lot of new stuff that's in there. And we actually have 42 people registrants for this virtual course. So it was a 3-week course. I think it actually started on Tuesday, ended on Thursday a couple weeks later. And then in 92, we were listening to what the industry was saying. We can't spend 3 weeks away from our offices or our plants. So we condensed everything with a few minor exceptions into 2 weeks and packed it in. So that 2 weeks, as you can attest, is pretty busy from 8 to 5 or even later with lectures and labs and demos and all that kind of stuff. And so it went on until, I think it's been about 2010. And, you know, I remember the day that I heard that NCA was pulling out of it, and kind of, you know, my jaw dropped to the floor thinking, well, what am I going to do? But ultimately, you know, University of Wisconsin has a strong outreach extension program. And after talking with some of those people, I realized that I could do this myself. And so the money that used to go to NCA to organize, and you know, they pay for the part-time person that put it together. I use that money now to pay grad students. And so those grad students help me run the class, while at the same time they get a master's degree in some kind of candy-related topic, and then they go out and populate the candy industry with master's level technical people. So it's turned from something that I was taken aback by that change to I think a real advantage to both the University of Wisconsin and the industry.
I would highly recommend it. It was a phenomenal experience.
And just to build on that, we take 33 people because that's all we can handle in the labs, but we typically now have 60 people on the wait list. And registration this past December, the registration for the course that would have started yesterday, we filled that course in less than 12 hours. And so some of the people that were on last year's waiting list got on this year's waiting list because they didn't sign up early enough. So there's still a huge demand for it. And because we couldn't offer it this year, we're gonna offer it twice next year. So just a notice to heads up, we're gonna teach it in the first 2 weeks of June. And then again, I think it's the last week of July and the first week of August, kind of accommodating the IFT schedule. So we're going to offer it twice next summer. It's going to kill us, but because that it's a lot of work. But we figure we have to accommodate this year's kind of fiasco.
I'm smelling a franchise. Maybe you could sell it off to somebody who can run it. That's kind of a joke, but.
Yeah. It is a big thing. And, I don't know when Terry Richardson stopped his course and then the Davis course kind of ended. There's really nothing else out there. And so I think everybody's turning to us. And I keep thinking about how can we meet the demand in a logical way. If you remember, there was a time when, there's always been demand. And there was a time when, one, we opened it up to anybody who wanted it. So we actually had 45 attendees 1 year. That was a fiasco because how do you get 45 people into the space that we have in the pilot plant? We decided we'd never do that again. But then a couple of years later, and this was with NCA, we decided that we would run a split course. I don't know if you remember that.
Yep.
We ran the first week 1 year and then the second week the next year. And it was, it was a way of getting more people. But what it did was it scavenged the two-week course the second year, so we didn't fill up in that one. I think all told, we covered more people, but again, we didn't fill up in the two-week course the second year that we did it. So yeah. I said, well, that's probably not a good approach. And so, I'm thinking of what are alternatives. With the virtual course that we're doing now, I'm thinking that maybe there are elements of that I can do. But I worry a little bit about the market for it. And, I know PMCA is thinking about that same thing. And, it's a lot of effort to put together an online class. And then if nobody signs up for it, you're kind of left holding the bag. So I don't know if this experience this summer has changed my opinion. I still need to think it through and wait till the end of the course and get feedback from the attendees.
Yeah, that ties into, I'm gonna follow up with, regarding the current situation, the virtual classroom, the minimal social interaction. How do you find that affecting the food science students? And as a follow-up to that, do the students take you seriously while you're teaching in your pajamas?
Well, I don't, so I don't have to worry about that. However, it's always interesting when, people turn their videos on and it's pretty clear they're wearing bathrobes and stuff like that. But I don't. Not that I get dressed up all the time, but not that I get dressed up ever, right? I think that, students are pretty resilient. And while I think that online classes are not nearly as good a learning experience as being in class and face-to-face. There's a lot of things that you can do with an online mode. In fact, my food science, my candy science class that I teach to our food science students has always had an online component. So I taped, I don't know, 40 different lectures of me doing Candy School way back in 2003 or something like that. And that's been the basis for my Candy School. So I teach it, or Candy Course, and I teach it in, you know, what now in the educational jargon is a flipped course model, where they watch videos online over the weekend, and then they come into class on Monday, and we talk about the stuff that they learned. I have a set of learning questions and learning outcomes that we go through. Of course, most of the time is spent tasting a lot of different candies for that particular candy category and talking about what's different and, you know, why a Jolly Rancher is different from a Lifesaver and stuff like that. So there's a direct interaction with them after they've done the videos, and they have to take a quiz to confirm that they've watched the videos. And then we go to the lab the next day and actually, you know, make candies that you know, might represent Jolly Ranchers versus Lifesavers, so they can get to see all the interesting experiences. So, you know, I've had an online component, and it's worked okay. This year, actually, I plan to do that class in person. So we have the freedom of choosing whether we want to do online or in person. And I have a small enough class that I can handle everything in person. And again, they'll watch the videos online instead of watching me lecture. And then they'll come to class. I still need to sort out how we're going to do the tasting and still be 6 feet apart. And then how we're going to do labs and still be 6 feet apart. And then there's people that can't make it to class. So I've got to make sure that everything we do is recorded in some way. And so it's a challenge. But again, I think students are really resilient. And I don't know. I think the good students learn almost no matter how you teach. And
very encouraging. It's very encouraging that they're that resilient and adept at learning this style of what we're forced into now.
And I think some of them really gravitate towards it because, you know, they sit in class and they're bored, whereas when they're watching online, they can stop it and go back to it. So I think there's some that really like the idea of having online stuff with recorded material that they can go back and look at when they want to. In their pajamas, by the way.
Nice. What inspires you most by your past and present students' achievements?
Yeah, so I really enjoy working with students. I mean, I think I'm really fortunate that, you know, that I have generally a really bright set of students, students that are really motivated on average. You know, we have our, who I wouldn't call them slackers per se, although sometimes I think they are. They remind me of me when I was a kid. and so, you know, that their passion, their curiosity, their diligence, I mean, it's a really inspiring attitude that keeps me going. So, you know, really, it's the students that keep me here and doing what I'm doing. So it's just that, you know, that they're just so interested and curious and want to learn and have great optimistic ideas for the future. And, you know, my job is to foster that and push them along in their technical learning as much as I can while making sure that they're building skills at the same time so that they can actually accomplish their goals.
What do you see as being major benefits in collaborating with industry organizations such as PMCA or AACT?
Well, so the first thing I did when I came to Wisconsin was took the 3-week candy course. But the month after that, Joe had me down at Callaway Gardens at the PMCA meeting that year. And that was eye-opening to me. You know, one, Joe was really popular. You know, he was a great guy, well-respected in the industry. And, you know, and he was a schmooze. So we would be at the bar and, you know, people would be lining up to buy him beers. And, you know, there was a line of 5 beers just because people were buying it for him. And he was, you know, he's just so well respected. Of course, the next day on the plane after that, I was bitching about, Joe, why'd you make me do that? And I've learned to moderate that a little bit, and it's easier when Joe's not there, but it became really clear that his connection with the industry was a huge benefit to to everything he did, primarily the short courses, but you know, he had a research program in confections as well. And so I've treated my interaction with the industry as a source of research projects. I mean, I can break it down as simple as that. It's way more complicated, of course. But when I talk to industry people about what things they're concerned about, those are ideas for me to build into potential research projects. And, you know, I can check off over the years all the different things that that I've picked up from either consulting or just going to ACT and PMCA meetings and saying, well, they really don't know what's going on there. And that's a great idea for a research project. And, you know, and so I've had success doing that all the way from USDA to the industry grants. So to me, it's been a huge benefit to talk to industry, get to sense what they're thinking about, and turn those into research projects. And then the second element of that is getting the perspective of what are the concerns of industry so that I can relay those to the students. So while I don't have candy industry experience, you know, I think all the work that I've done and interactions that I've had with candy companies and individuals at candy companies has helped me better prepare my students for going out into that industry.
So what are one of the most interesting projects you're working on right now that you can share with us?
Well, most of the stuff I do is not confidential. I do have one industry project that is semi-confidential, but for whatever reason, I ended up having one of my candy grad students slight offset from that. But I won't talk about that. But the primary thing that I think we're doing now that's of interest is stickiness. You know, when we reduce sugar and replace it with something else, often the problem is stickiness. And understanding stickiness is, you know, every once in a while, I kind of change paths or open a new direction, maybe a better way to say it, open a new direction of research. And stickiness is one of those. You know, I joke that it's a sticky subject, whatever. But it's one of those complex areas that, you know, there's industries that, you know, that's what they do. So 3M, you know, those sticky notes, they have a really good sense of pressure sensitive adhesives. And there's this whole knowledge in a different field that we're now starting to apply to confections. And so if there's a PMCA call for research funding, I'm probably going to put something in about stickiness in general, because it applies to all different types of confections, and particularly as you start reducing sugar, you cause problems. And so we have, you know, we're trying to take some of the fundamental approaches that the PSA, pressure sensitive adhesive industries, use and apply them to our stuff, including things like, you know, using atomic force microscopy to understand. One of the interesting things that we've just published is the effect of sugar crystals on stickiness, more for a cereal coating standpoint, but you know, the hypothesis was if you have a sugar crystal on an amorphous sugar surface, that sugar crystal is not sticky, and the stickiness of the entire complex is reduced proportionately to what the surface coverage of crystals is. And we actually proved that was the case. So I think there's some really interesting stuff on stickiness. That's what's getting me excited these days, as you can tell.
Well, I like the way you have, it's always front of your mind, maybe the applications, the impact to this industry, or even the membership.
Yeah, again, that's kind of the way I think. And, you know, where they came about, I mean, there's faculty members that build their careers on basic research, more basic research, and other faculty members that focus more on applied research. And I like to think I have a mix of both, but I think that the applied standpoint is really, I mean, maybe that comes from being an engineer, but I like to see the things that we do applied and help solve problems.
That's what we love about you, though, is that you go on a deep dive, but you make it relatable as well, and it applies so perfectly.
Well, thanks for saying that, Eric, because that is exactly what I try to do.
So where do you see the future of research through technology, maybe trending topics or things like that?
Yeah, that's always a hard one to, get that crystal ball out. And I keep thinking I study crystals, so I should have a crystal ball here. But as I joke in class, if you pull out one of these fancy glass things, and they're called crystals, but they're really glass. So that conundrum of what's a crystal and what's a glass is always interesting. But I'll get out of my crystal ball. And, I think that there are new technologies that are coming out and new ingredients, probably the main thing. So, what's going to solve this reduced sugar trend that we're focused on? And, it's undoubtedly going to be ingredient development and, things with improved functionality and understanding what that functionality is. So kind of bridging the gap between components, ingredients, and their functionality from a molecular basis. So that's probably where I still see a really strong future of research. Now, granted, that's sort of my area of research, but and again, I think there's always advanced technologies that are coming out. So, one of the big things that we're seeing is starchless molding as an interesting example of potential technology that could really revolutionize the industry in the future. So I think all of that, both technology and ingredient functionality are both still things that we need to be thinking about.
Final question. You probably do intersect with other departments. Would you be interested in working with anything within these departments, such as agricultural science or chemistry or marketing, computer science, anything like that?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I'm pretty open to doing interdisciplinary work. I have not had much interaction with computer science, agronomy and horticulture. I think there's some really interesting things in that direction. In fact, as a department, we're talking about how can we build better bridges with them. We're doing it in the dairy industry where there's a new dairy innovation hub here at in Wisconsin, not just UW-Madison, where it incorporates everything from the animal farmers, the production agriculture, to the dairy processing side like we would do, but also the economics and marketing type of thing. So it's really all encompassing, anything that relates to dairy and trying to improve its structure. We're trying to do the similar thing with, we're focusing on things that we can do within the state. So I don't know if a ginseng laced candy is the next thing, but ginseng is a pretty big product in Wisconsin, and we're trying to build connections like that. One great example of that is something that Joe did with a guy in horticulture, and Joe is big in color technology, color science, and he and Irwin over in horticulture developed a beet, a red beet that was high in betalains color content. So instead of beets as food, he saw beets as being a source of color. And, beetroot red is an important natural color at this point. When he was doing it, he said, well, nobody's going to use this stuff in the future. But, here we are with, everybody wanting to use natural type stuff. And it's just taken off. Joe patented that at Wharf with Irwin. And it's been licensed by a Wisconsin company. So it's a great example of how, that connection can really turn into something valuable. And I think that, we need to be looking at doing more of that.
Very nice. Very nice. So where can they get the book?
Probably the best thing is Amazon. I think it's available as an ebook. But it's available at the Springer website, but I think it's actually cheaper at Amazon.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an interview with Rich Hartel from University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks for joining us today, Doctor.
Happy to do it. Always glad to talk about the candy industry.
This has been another episode of PMCA Research Chat. Please subscribe and like us on your podcast service. Check us out at pmca.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.